Hello, and welcome to the Flat Nickel Podcast. This week, your hosts Hannah Nawa and me, Sam Fritz, talk to independent artist The Herd of Main Street. Jenna and Peter McKibben are the core of the Baltimore-based band The Herd of Main Street. Heralded Baltimore's modern-day version of the band by Fly Magazine, the group curated their full-bodied sound over their past five albums. The husband and wife songwriters sat down with us to discuss their booking frustrations, unique fans, and their latest album, Heyday. First, let us set the scene. The interview picks up mid-conversation as we're talking about their comparison to the band. Hannah takes the lead in this interview as she booked the band to play at the Thought Lot. In the background, early on, you will hear a little bit of background noise. Those noises are the sounds of setting up for soundcheck, and one creaky ladder who will make a slight appearance during the interview. One interesting thing about this interview is that it takes place both before and after their performance, and the tone noticeably shifts between the two as well. With that, let's get into our interview with The Herd of Main Street.
Yeah, because it's not a bunch of male voices, it's a male and female voices, but
I think what the band captures, though, is that they tend to get that term Southern Rock, but you don't usually mention the band and the Allman Brothers in the same kind of vein. It's not like I love Skynyrd and the band.
Yeah.
But the band still conjures up so much of rural America that it becomes Southern Rock, so I think that's why I really like that quote for us, because it's easy for us to say, oh, like someone says, what do you sound like? You rattle off these names of bands that you think people have heard of. Mm-hmm. But when in reality, I think that our thematic side is more of the Southern Rock side than what we sound like. So that's a good quote.
Do you think that the Southern Rock has, that sort of genre has inspired a lot of your songwriting? Is that what influences you as a writer?
I mean, very much. Southern Rock to me, though, comes like, what's strange is I feel like Southern Rock is born out of what actually took place in Bakersfield, California in the mid-60s, because you get Honky Tonk and it's adding like twangier guitars and you're getting more drums and more of a backbeat to this country music. So all of a sudden guys that were down south in Georgia pick up on that and bring a rock and roll side to it.
And soul music.
Yeah, so I feel like that's where this like Southern Rock is actually born out of the West Coast, and just the way it fuels into the country is how you get that, not cliche, but like what everyone knows is the Southern Rock sound.
Are the artists that you typically spend time listening to the same artists that are influencing your writing? Or like, are you listening to the band? Are you listening to Merle Haggard? Are those the sort of...
I could say yes to almost anybody you mentioned. I listen to so much music. I mean, it's always around me.
He works in a record store also, and we have like 3,000, 4,000 plus records in the house.
But when it comes to, like you say, like
it's someone just that on all the time
influences the writing side, I love to listen to a lot of soul music, but we don't really play soul music in the band or as the duo. But yet some of the lyrics of, say, someone like George Jackson, who worked with Clarence Carter, who I've been listening to a lot of lately, and it's definitely influences the words. And I think sometimes with music you can always pull something out of it, whether it's a rhythm, a groove, a feel, a lyric. And I think a lot of music that I listen to might not be in one genre, but I tend to look for those pieces to put together your own puzzle.
Right, but
I don't think I get compared to people that I listen to on a regular basis. Like Warren Zevon is one of my all-time favorite songwriters, and never has anyone said, you know what you guys sound like?
Yeah.
But I wish they would. And I listen to a lot more like British Celtic-y stuff than what comes out, I think, in our writing, even in my own writing. But when people say we're a Southern Rock band, I think they're accurate, but when I'm describing our band, I never say Southern Rock, because I think it evokes something in some people that they think it's maybe like, you know, too rednecky for them or whatever. And even though I love Skynyrd and the Allman Brothers or whatever, I think it's, when you say the band or Americana, it shows that your palate goes a little bit deeper than the classic rock.
What do you describe the sound as?
I don't know. I think it's more of like a classic country band, or a classic rock in the real sense that it sounds like it's from the 70s.
Yeah, the old school. I definitely hear a lot of old school country in your guys' sound. I think that's what...
When I look back at what I listen to, I don't think I have listened to anything from like after 1978 in a while. So
except Warren Zevon.
Well, yeah, the later Warren albums, but that definitely comes through, you know, in our writing.
As far as the actual songwriting process goes for you guys, does someone normally, is there someone who normally approaches the other with like, hey, I have an idea? Is someone more in charge of lyrics than sound? Is that something that you collaborate on, writing lyrics together?
We really write our own songs pretty separately.
I wish we could just say that
present them.
Like our house is filled with music and it's a nice image to think of us sitting around like the piano or the guitar.
Equally, but that's
equally,
not.
Yeah.
And I think when people say that they write together, it's never like that. It's never that like harmonious. I'm just sitting here playing a little guitar riff and suddenly this inspiration just pops into your brain. Like I think one person always has like kind of the skeletal framework of the song and the other person is helping arrange it or adding different parts to it. But
songwriting is just something
he's a lot more prolific.
That's, I think
I
you can't really force. So sometimes when you do sit down with someone and say, all right, let's have a songwriting session, it can almost put this weight on you where you feel like whatever happens has to be permanent, like that something has to come out of this. And when it's a little more free and you wait for it to come to you, I think you get more creative than let's crank out this songwriting machine.
It's more true to your vision. You don't have to be democratic about it. You can be like, this is the song that I'm bringing to the table. What do you think I need to change about it? And like, I'll write one song for maybe every like six songs that he can just crank out, and they're all good. And I'll say to him like he's much more concerned and much better with lyrics than I am because I'm a guitarist. So all I really care about is writing cool guitar parts. And I'll be like, well, how can I change these words to be more interesting, or just use him as like a thesaurus so that I don't sound too trite in the lyrics or whatever.
You're trite.
And there you go. Word. That's a word that that you would have come up with. And I think vice versa, I add more of the string arrangement type parts when your songs are brought to me. So that's kind of how
do you guys ever disagree about how you think a song should go if you have those conversations
we have one right now going on.
Really?
I'm not sure if we're playing that song tonight because
what song are you talking about?
Mansion. Well, yeah. We can do it as a duo, but we brought it to some other musicians for trying to get like a groove to it, and we have very different ideas for the drums right now. So while it is her song,
I don't think very different.
I didn't like what Lance said.
Well, I didn't even tell him what to play on it. That was the trouble. But yeah, it's weird trying to bring it to the full band. We play about half our shows duo, half our shows full band, and we write, you know, on our own, and then we can very easily. We live together. We're married. We know each other's brains, so we can, you know, rehearse it on our own very easily. When we bring it to them, it takes a lot more effort to get it
arranged. All on the same page. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it easier to collaborate, do you think, because you're married and because you're sort of,
I would
use the
so.
Word symbiotic. Does that make sense?
We know
sense?
Each other very well. Yeah.
I think, though, what comes out of that for me, though, I'll disagree with you on that for this. Because I think one thing with when you're, whether playing or writing with your spouse, I feel like there's still that's the person that you hold up on a pedestal. So if I bring something that I think is even somewhat subpar, I know that she's going to know right away that he's dialing this in. Like, this isn't what he's capable of, something better than this.
There's definitely that sensitivity that you like you get.
So therefore,
you
know, I don't want to bring a rough idea. If I want to show her a song, I want to make sure that I'm confident with it, because I know she'll see right through it, because she knows who I am perfectly.
I think that's why we write the way we do. Like, it has to be kind of finished before we start.
So when you write with someone you don't know, you can even fall into, you can kind of steamroll them. If you're more confident in the song, you don't need to have their opinion if you're ready to go with it. But when you write with, you know, someone that you're going to share your life with, I'm not going to steamroll, like, ah, you're wrong on this. Like, no, it's got to be a give and take, and I think that you really benefit from that give and take.
But the good part about it is that you know each other's strengths really well, and you can start to write to those strengths. Like when I write, I know I don't like to sing on my own, would never want to have anything to do with singing unless this duo existed, just because you have to fill in, you know, the space that's lacking with a full band. So when I write, I always make sure that there's lots of harmony parts for him or lead parts for him to sing so that I can just sit and play various string instruments. And he does the same thing for me when he writes. Kind of plays to each other's...
Sure.
To each other's strengths.
Is the singing thing something that you were sort of coaxed into as to be a part, be a part of the band, but as...
I was definitely coaxed into it. I don't think I'm, like, bad at it or anything. It's just not something that I... ever,
it's great,
like,
having her sing, though.
To do.
Having her sing, too, is because she hears harmony parts much, much more than I do. And I will tend to always, if you ask me to sing a harmony, I will go to the same one that I know how to do. I'll probably, what is it, a fifth or something like that. But she can hear different harmony parts that make the song more interesting. And it's a struggle for me to always learn those parts. But it definitely comes from her being able to hear the human voice better.
Well, in general, I just hear harmony parts because I started out as a guitarist, and I, you know, that's what I focused on for 10 plus years. So that's what I consider myself first a guitarist before a songwriter or a singer or anything else. So yeah, I definitely focus on, when I hear a song, I'm listening to the instrumental parts of the song primarily first, and then if the voice sounds okay, I'll focus on that the next time I hear the song. But definitely I'm focused, I'm dialed in on the instruments.
It's also, being a guitar player, much easier to pick out your harmonies, because every chord is a root, a third, and a fifth.
Because you're playing harmony all the time. Even when you play lead, you play harmony.
Exactly. So it definitely, like, translates easier. One question that, and this harkens back way to when we started even talking about this, but you mentioned how when you listen to music, you kind of pick out puzzle pieces and take that into your own music. Do you do that on a song-by-song basis, or does that translate to an album? You know, do you kind of write a bunch of songs, and then when you have an album that fits with all of them together, you put it together? Or?
I think the first process comes song-by-song, and then it comes down to, are these songs kind of telling their own story, or do I have an odd man out that needs to maybe hold off for the next puzzle, so to speak? And you kind of build up that song bank. And, I mean, there might be a song that just hasn't felt right with a project, but I can sit on that. If I'm confident in that song, I'll know that it'll always be there. But it might get left out if it's not the right piece at the right time.
Mm-hmm. You kind of see which ones have some more themes, and they end up being the ones that are put together on the album. Or for this last album, I mean, it just all kind of came together so quickly.
Are either of you professionally trained, or are you both self-taught?
I guess I can call myself professionally trained because I have a music degree, but I was self-taught long before I got that degree. So
self-taught. I don't know what the hell I'm doing half the time.
Yeah,
but it works. I think that's what matters. Is that it works?
There's 10 holes on the harmonica. They make sound. I know which ones to put in the right order. But
yeah.
I think that kind of comes with the territory, too. The southern rock sound is probably, I'd say, the most some guy in his basement just learned how to play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially in modern music, I think with alternative rock, we're getting a lot of classically trained musicians coming into the industry.
I think one of the best examples, though, is guitarist James Burton, who was a guy who was a in-demand session player, from playing on Susie Q with Dale Hawkins to playing with... Graham Parsons, to Elvis Presley, to Emmylou Harris. But yeah, this was a guy who worked in California as a studio musician, and they'd say, here, I need you to learn this. And he's like, I can't read this chart. He's like, I'll give you the James Burton sound, and I can play what you want. He's like, but it's going to have to be from me listening to the song and playing it. And he stayed in, I mean, he's known today as one of the greats.
That's a rare
thing. And that's a southern gentleman. I mean, it was, like you said, it comes out of that, like, yes, it's this, you know, it can be considered the good old boy who can't read. But at the same time, the guy's an artist. And I think there is a lot of that exists in that genre.
Yeah, nothing about being able to read music makes you a good musician or even an interesting musician. I mean, it's just a mathematical equation that some brains can understand and some brains haven't been taught yet. It's not difficult to do, and it doesn't, like, translate any emotion at all. It's just literally, you know, a framework of somebody else's piece. So being being classically trained isn't necessarily a good thing, especially when you're doing original music.
One of the things, my dad is a banjo player.
I know this.
You don't. But one of the things that his teacher, Kevin Nida, who's a really just amazing banjo player, an all-around musician, but my dad can't, like, it was for him, it was very mathematical, it was very just black and white.
Yeah.
And his teacher kept saying to him, like, you have to have some sort of emotional feeling towards this because you can tell when people are feeling the music that they're making as opposed to.
That's a great point, yeah.
And I think there's definitely been, even in my experience, artists that are, they view it as just a job to get done. And when you're not emotionally invested in the things that you're creating, I feel like there's a disconnect with the audience. And I think you guys are really, I mean, my mother loves you. Just let's get that out there. My mother is obsessed with you.
And we love her.
But the first time that they saw you at the festival that you played here, you were so enticing. Mm-hmm. And I think you both really feel passionately about what you do. And that comes across when you're playing
on stage.
Very much so.
Definitely passionate about it. Yeah.
I think that's an amazing thing.
And I think what helps with that, I mean, I'll go right into it, is this venue too. This venue pulls out, I think, something in the creative person where you want to perform and you want to capture that feeling of the evening while you're here. Played some venues where it's just you feel like a distraction. And yes, they've booked music. The booker might not even be there that night, so when you show up with your guitar case, the bartender is like, what do you want?
Yeah, no one knows what you're there for.
Yeah, it's like, we're who you asked to be here this evening. And then, of course, you know, we played one venue and they told us that we were too loud. Mm-hmm. And we thought, like, you booked us. Like, you knew what to expect.
You
and
know
I think
what
we
sound like.
A place like this where everyone just seems so interested and so involved that it really does, I think, bring out the best musicians when they come out here.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Sorry. That does raise an interesting question with venues and promoters and whoever books you and that kind of stuff. Do you, like, as independent artists, I feel like you guys have every intention of trying to win over the crowd by the end of the concert, you know, mm-hmm. to gain fans and a following and all that. But, you know, do people who book you, do they frustrate you sometimes with how
Absolutely.
They try and boss you around?
Absolutely. I'm the one that does all the booking, so that's my just... I think one of Hannah's questions said, like, how do you stay positive through the booking process? You don't through the booking process. But the only positive thing about it is looking at that calendar at the end of the day and being like, okay, there's like 20 some dates on here. That's a real sense of accomplishment because of what you had to go through to get to it. But the way they annoy you is booking. The first thing I look at if a venue asks me to play is how many original acts do they have there on a regular basis? Because if it's mostly cover bands, I won't even entertain the thought of playing there. That's why the Thought Lot is so cool, because I know you guys appreciate original music, and that means a lot, because it's just getting more and more rare to find that. So I look at that first. That usually annoys me, the amount of cover bands that I see being booked. And then they'll want, like, maybe three bands a night to play. One will be a reggae band, one will be us, and the next will be, like, a hip-hop.
Yeah.
Like, who are you pleasing? How is that going
to
be, like...
It's like they throw all these nets out and try to catch everyone in the room, and what they end up doing is...
Annoying everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is going to be pleased at the end of that night? Like, how is that going to end up?
And musicians too. I mean,
all annoyed. The venue's annoyed. The patrons are annoyed. Everybody's just annoyed. Or like booking agents that don't listen to the music beforehand. It just doesn't make any sense. If you're going to ask me to be there, because a lot of the times you'll get people emailing you who have heard you on like a AAA station or read a pull-out quote about you in some small newspaper, and they won't go on YouTube or take the 10 seconds to go on SoundCloud to figure out what you sound like. And then
a while back we went through this weird thing
one
where
that you were talking about, I won't say it by name, but they booked us with a bunch of bluegrass acts, seeing that, like, I play slide and mandolin, so thinking, like, oh, it must be a bluegrass
band. Yeah, we went through an awkward, month of, like, these places booking us, and we get there, and we turned out, like, they were booking us for bluegrass.
Yeah.
And a couple of the shows, we brought the full band with all amps, and it didn't go over well, but it was fun.
I mean, we're definitely influenced by bluegrass music.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't imagine that the audience wasn't too into it. I mean, if you like Southern rock, you definitely have some tendency to bluegrass.
The audience was fine, but the venue itself was like very perplexed that there was a drum set.
Yeah.
And that there was an electric guitar.
Most of the crowd was seasoned ticket holders who were in their 70s.
Yeah. Mm.
So it was a very strange evening.
And even when we play the duo, I never play acoustic guitar. Never.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that happened, but booking agents can definitely be your best friends, or they can just ruin your day.
Are there things that venues can do that either like make you feel more comfortable, or that make you what makes you want to return? Because you guys have been here mm-hmm. 3 times now.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah.
And obviously, we enjoy having you guys. That's why we keep asking you back. But you keep coming back, which is probably a good sign.
It's always good to have a record store in your venue, right? For me especially. Yeah, that's always comes in handy.
Well, I make a list of venues that I just keep on the back burner if I need to, fill the calendar of ones that I love and that I know love us. So number one on the list that they can do is tell you that they liked your performance. That'll make you definitely more likely to come back. And number two, offer a guarantee. You know, pay your entertainers for the work that they're providing. Even if it's like, I can offer you a guarantee of like $30. Okay, that's fair. Like, at least you're shooting straight with me. When it's like...
Music's tough because I feel like it's in this world of... You want to have the attitude of, you know, we do this for the love of it. It's a passion. And it is, and we, you know, do love it. But then when it comes down to the end of the day, I mean, it takes gas money to get to any venue. Mm-hmm. Whether it's an hour away or whether it's 4 hours away. It still takes a little bit of planning.
And when you get to the point that we are, or even, like, not even as far a point that we're at, it becomes a large part of your income, and you need to maintain that income because you're taking off work from your part-time job to do your gigs. And, you know, once you get to the point where you're doing it professionally and you want to be a professional musician full-time, you have to maintain that, you know.
That's why I'm glad to see a lot of venues that
salary
used to be a thing where it would be kind of like a pay-to-play situation. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a lot of those kind of fall to the wayside now. And I'm glad to see that I think musicians won out on that kind of ongoing battle. Mm-hmm. There was a venue that was outside Baltimore that was very well known, and it used to book a lot of really good acts, from Johnny Winter to Modesky Martin and Wood. I mean, it was an interesting spot.
You can just call it the Record. It doesn't exist anymore.
It does, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Instead of venue anymore, for that reason.
Yeah, all of a sudden, the bands that started playing there were these high school bands, and no one could figure out, why is these underage high schoolers getting this spot? Who is the booking agent? And then it turns out it's you pay to play. Mm-hmm. So if mommy and daddy had enough money to have, you know, Johnny play on the big stage, that's who was getting it.
I think that we're definitely seeing that trend of pay to play.
Oh, really?
Dissipate.
Okay, good, yeah.
Like, it's something that I remember when I first started booking was really prevalent. Mm-hmm. And I when I was booking for shows in Baltimore, it felt like it was...
Mm-hmm.
Almost always pay to play.
It still happens a lot in Baltimore. We just know who's doing it, and we hate it.
Yeah, I think it has been starting to go away.
Yeah, it's starting to... I think people are realizing that it's sort of an unfair treatment for artists.
And for everybody. The audience, too. Like, you're paying these, you know, $7 to $10 to $20 ticket prices for these high schoolers, you know... I wouldn't pay it. Why should you?
I think that's interesting to hear, because aside from the music world, I also really enjoy stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. And stand-up mm-hmm. comedy is the definition of pay-to-play.
Yeah. Really?
Anybody
the
who's trying
used to have a lot of stand-up comedy.
Anybody who's trying to break in, especially I lived in New York for 3 months over the summer, not a single place was you could just go, and if you wanted to do an open mic, you could. You had mm-hmm. to pay. You had to pay $5 to register, and then you had to buy a drink while you were there. That was the general rule for most places. So it's more than pay to play.
Yeah.
Wow. You know,
pay to perform.
Pay to stay, even if you got to have a drink if you want
to
be there.
In
so.
The room.
A lot of venues, when I've been working in Nashville, a lot of venues are if you come in to see a show, you mm-hmm. pay the cover and then you have to buy two drinks.
Mm-hmm. I think seeing a show is a little bit different.
But no, I don't really like that either.
I don't agree with the policy, I think, on either end, no.
I
was going to bring up Nashville. It's interesting that you said that because I think, like, the more, like, supply and demand affects music performance as well. There's so many, now that, like, we're in this YouTube, Instagram, mm-hmm. selfie generation, everybody's a star, yet nobody's a star. Like, nobody's as big a star as, like, Zeppelin or the Rolling Stones mm-hmm. anymore because there's just too, like, that era of just being a legend is gone because there's just too much. But everybody can have their own YouTube channel and their own subscribers and their own SoundCloud and whatever. And there's just so much supply for these venues that they can kind of, if you don't prove yourself, they can treat you like crap. And especially where in cities like Nashville and New York and LA where, like, it's known for being a music town, that's where they try to take advantage of you more. That's why we like playing, you know. You go out to the salt of the earth little towns, and they have the best venues, and they have the best people, and the best fans, because they're just not living in that world, where it's just too much. Too many bands and too many venues to keep it interesting.
That's an interesting point, because I think that, for the most part, when we think about the fact that most people who are independent artists have access to SoundCloud and Facebook and Instagram, where they're sort of able to build a following, mm-hmm. but it does lead to so much saturation. And you're right, those super big names really mm-hmm. aren't... That phenomenon isn't really there anymore.
Yeah.
But it does seem like it helps... at least smaller bands mm-hmm. sort of make a living or be able to climb to the next step.
You definitely have more opportunity at your fingertips if you just, you know, have the talent to back it up and you utilize it correctly. But
I do also think that there's a glass ceiling for independent artists, especially those who want to remain independent. You know, for example, Chance the Rapper, who is probably peak independent artist right now, the first streaming only artist to win a Grammy.
Mm-hmm.
His glass ceiling's much higher because he's in the top 40.
Right.
So he has a lot to gain from not necessarily going right to a label. But you know, mm-hmm. Southern rock, which at least in the modern context is not reaching the top 40
mm-hmm.
often, if at all. You know, when the Black Keys put out a new album,
mm-hmm.
that's probably the closest that it gets.
And they
you know,
don't call it Southern Rock anymore. You definitely can't call it that anymore.
I think the Allman Brothers would disagree
yeah.
with that.
Well, yeah, you can call them Southern Rock.
But
if you're coming up as a new band, you're not cool if you say, like, oh, we're Southern Rock. We're a Southern Rock band. That's just not, that's too old school. It's been done. It's not original enough. You have to say we're Americana. Because somehow
that's the
different.
Thing.
Somehow
Americana,
that means a different thing.
But I think Americana is being very different from Southern Rock. Like, I view them as being two kind of separate genres.
Genres are always the curse of any musical conversation.
It's all just rock and roll that's influenced by country music.
That's something that gets...
It's also a very modern thing of, mm-hmm. you know, back in the day, you had rock and roll, you had country, you had soul, and,
yeah.
you know, R&B, and that was, you know, about it. But even then, soul and R&B are almost like subgenres of each other. Now you've got a million different genres
so
just for rock and
roll. So many subgenres, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was a heavy metal fan, and I used to love the genres he would tell me about folk metal.
Mm-hmm.
There's very much difference between Swede metal to like Norway metal. Like there was so many subgenres in the genre.
The Norwegian death metal scene is. I mean, there's a documentary. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
like
it's a great
Vice,
documentary too. Yeah.
Vice went over to Norway and just documented the whole thing. It's amazing because with Norway, they're actually a huge electronic scene over there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of DJs come out of there, and then also their club scene is just death metal.
Yeah.
Love it.
And that's why I think like people need a genre so bad. Like they need to know like what is this? Tell me what it is by using as little as many words possible. And I think when you break away from that, I think you have much more of an experience with an art form. And I think whether you want to call it Southern rock or folk metal, like say there's a band playing tonight, tickets are cheap, come check it out, and mm-hmm. find out if you like it or not. Mm-hmm. Don't base it on, right. what do you call this music? Come on in and find out. And I think that's what the best venues do, is make it accessible to come on in and see what it's all about.
Do you think that it's difficult for people to, because one of the things that we experience a lot is we can't get people to go see a band that they've never heard of.
Oh,
is
yeah.
that,
yeah.
Like, I'm not crazy. This is a good, no, common occurrence.
Think of what you have to compete with now, too.
Yeah. Like, you can just sit on your whatever.
You can binge watch an entire
watch
season
Netflix,
something.
You
and
don't
not,
have to go anywhere. Yeah. Like, going out is not a thing anymore like it used to be. You used to have, like, a musicians' union, and they knew that every venue was going to be packed with people wanting to dance. Any genre, it didn't matter back in the day. And now it's like,
just many more options.
You have to beg people to come out. And it's like, they just want to hear you play, you know, things that they already know.
Covers. They want to hear you play covers.
They want to hear you play covers. And even if they know some of your songs, they'll ask for specific songs of yours that they know that are, you know, however many years old.
I think our favorite one of that was, we were in a venue, and it was just the two of us playing. And a gentleman in the front there, he's having a good time. And he sees a mandolin sitting there, and he says, "Oh, you brought your mandolin. You gonna play 'Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You' by Led Zeppelin?" And we look at each other, and we're like, "Wait, number one, I don't think there's a mandolin on that song."
There's definitely not.
So then, like, the wheels are turning, and we said, "Okay, well, so no, I'm not gonna play that." He goes, "Well, I know how to play it."
And he like went to reach for his guitar, and I was like, "You're not gonna play it tonight, like."
And then he asked if we knew any songs by Rush.
Now, as an acoustic duo.
We're sitting there with an acoustic guitar and a mandolin, like, singing harmonies, and he asked for some Rush. And
I mean, I think if you actually ask Geddy Lee that question,
right.
maybe he'd be like, yeah, I can take this mandolin and play
yeah.
Rush.
Yeah, maybe.
But that's such an obscure thing to ask.
He was just trying to be obnoxious, and he was mm-hmm. succeeding. And he shortly left because nobody was getting the jokes.
But then we played Poor Tom by Led Zeppelin, and he didn't know the song. He didn't know it was Zeppelin.
Of course he
so
didn't, because
was
he has, like, the greatest hits, and that's as far as his, you know.
That was a fun night, though. That was a lot of fun.
That's as far as his little music listening experience can go.
It's a fun little side question. Do you have more or less fun with the obnoxious fans? Like, more often or not, do they help you have fun with the show, or have you had more experiences? Because I know, as a big Jack White fan, every time he brings up a fan, he didn't like him.
Yeah.
If a fan was obnoxious at a show, he didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
But for some, I know that they can play with it. Mac DeMarco loves fans that are being rowdy. Now, granted, that is kind of his aesthetic, but, you know, he loves fans that are being rowdy. How
I
does
love
it
when they're rowdy and having a good time to my music. I don't mind
rowdiness
being
is
loud.
Good. I think in the heat of the moment, though,
my rule is, if you scream at me, I scream at you. I had a guy scream Freebird at me, and I was like, really? Do you want to be that guy? Are you going to be that guy? Like, I embarrassed him, like, completely embarrassed him in front of his friends, and he left. And I was like, good. Goodbye. That's how you're going to be treated if you say that. Like, it's 2018. Why is that still a thing that you want to
say? I think
say?
The other side of that coin, though, is that is a person that came out.
So he came out, and he wanted to get drunk, and he succeeded.
You know, if you want to have a full house, You just deal with it.
He was also
and
screaming,
it does make for a good story afterwards. So I mean, I think you have
Brown.
To kind of just take it all in stride and remember why you're there in the first place. And if they can leave at the end of the night and wave goodbye to you, I mean, that's someone who listened at least, and they just listen in a different way. And I think it all just becomes part of the story.
I'm not like that at all. I don't like obnoxious fans.
I feel like you and I could also go have like a very long tangent about cover
yeah.
bands in general.
Oh God,
like,
why do it? What's the point?
At this point in the interview, we took a break so that the Herd of Main Street could begin their performance. Afterwards, we retired back to the green room and wrapped things up. You can noticeably see how all of us are a lot more comfortable with each other now that the performance has gotten out of the way.
Pull up these questions. Now it's a lot more relaxed. You know, I've had some chips and guacamole.
There
we're post-performing.
Well, we had a fan serving us wine the whole night.
Did you?
We were sitting there,
God.
Yeah. So.
You know what? God bless EG, because
yes.
she is like...
Now we got to get EG's permission.
She would give it.
I literally went up to her and I was like, hi. And she's like, are you hungry? Yeah. I wanted snacks.
Food.
Please give me food.
That was like gourmet.
Oh yeah, they're like,
she said, "Here's food, here's wine. Oh. By the way, I played tambourine with Led Zeppelin. Have a nice night."
And she was talking about like who was the other band?
Country Joe, Grateful Dead, Muddy Waters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Guy who I used to work with claimed to play.
Now you need to get all those people's permission to talk.
I won't use his name, but if he ever hears this, he'll love it. But he always claims that he played harmonica with U2. I believe him. The guy's the biggest U2 fan in the world. I'm sure he found his way on stage one way or another.
I was gonna say, I can't think of a song that has harmonica on it for U2, but...
You know what?
He was the guy, though. If you hear it, he's the guy.
I'll text him after this, and I'm sure he's going to have a full story about it. He's
fair enough.
One of the, as far as interviews, I'd love to interview him too, because he's got a story for everything. That's great.
Yeah.
I like though that when people are listening to this, they're very distinctly going to be able to tell what we recorded when we were still nervous and like unsure of what we're doing, and now it's like fans are serving you wine and we're just chilling out in the green room and it's a lot more relaxed and I probably sound a lot more like my normal self rather than I'm this timid little mouse that's afraid of the world.
It'll be a good advertisement for going to see live music.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, well, you never know who's going to give you chips and guacamole.
Yeah.
You know,
go out, eat food.
Yeah.
Hear things.
I guess, I mean, you know, to lead back into the questions of things, you got to ask some of them eventually.
The eyes.
Do house shows give you guys that kind of, you know, this, because I'm assuming that we're all having the same warm feeling right now post-show, right? You know, is that typical of a house show for you guys? Or, I mean, I guess a...
You calling us a house show?
Yeah, this is not a house show. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Do you guys play house shows, for starters?
I have never played
away from house shows.
I just got done writing a piece, which is why that keeps coming out of my mouth.
Okay, yeah, I've stayed away from it because I feel like... I mean, I play at my own house, and that's a house show. So if I want to go out and play, I want to play in front of some strangers, have some fun, see a different venue. You know, I want to treat myself if I'm going to be treating other people as well. So we don't do the house shows, but some venues
like
you pack up,
many either.
And you get that cold feeling. Like I think we talked earlier about how if the booker's not there, the venue doesn't know you, and sometimes you leave with this awkward question of. You know, okay, well, everybody have a nice time. But when it comes to a venue like this, you leave with people actually talking to you and telling you their experience and maybe sharing a story with you, and it just really brings it all together, and it's nice.
If you guys have really... If you have one of those shows where bookers don't show up, do you guys ever have a problem with getting paid?
No, but the booker then has to email us and say, hey, by the way, set up your PayPal account and pay me for booking you, even though I didn't come to the show.
There's a booking fee sometimes.
Yeah.
Wow, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that's a thing.
A couple
Maybe
breweries
it's a Maryland
have been doing
thing.
That. Yeah.
I had a brewery, the booker didn't show up and didn't pay us until two weeks later. I had to go drive back to the venue.
I've never had that. In my experience, when there is a booking fee, it's really easy to get paid, and usually the guarantee is larger. But, it's still kind of like, I had a guy email me the other week, like, the owner told me the gig went really well. That's really good to hear. And he emailed me that at, like, you know, 12:30 at night. And I realized it was him, like, nudging me, like, you haven't...
By the way.
You like, haven't sent my fee to the PayPal yet.
But, do you guys play... like, what do you guys play the most of? Do you guys play a lot of breweries? Do you guys play a lot of...
Right now, it seems like
venues?
A brewery... there's so many small craft beers going on right now, and all these breweries are so anxious to have people, and it's a draw. Mm-hmm. And, that's been kind of the way I think, if I were to recommend anything to a band starting out, or even a current band, breweries are great. There's usually a guarantee, it's a built-in crowd, the beer is flowing, people are in a good mood.
Do you feel like people don't pay? Like, would you rather play a brewery where... there's a guarantee and people show up, but they're sort of just in their own world, or would you rather play something that that's small and into... I'm putting you in a weird position right now because
we
just had
a
very small show.
Just last week, and it was already an event where like the town that was nearby was having their Spring Fest, and we happened to be the live music. So we go in there, and people are kind of like, why are these people carrying amplifiers? What is this? And they'd know. So then you kind of feel like you have to kind of win them over, and I feel like though that's not hard to do when people are already having a good time, so that's okay. But yeah, there are those times when I feel like
I would much rather play a music venue.
Yeah, like even tonight, I mean, I feel like when I sing a verse that I'm proud of, people are listening to it, and they're picking up on that, and they want to know, hey, tell me about that verse. And that's much more gratifying as an artist than it is just to play background music to a bunch of drunk folks.
But I also, I wouldn't classify any of those brewery gigs as background music either. Like, it, again, it comes down to your talent. If you're good enough to draw them in, then they will listen to you, whether you're meant to be sitting there eating dinner or not, you know. That's my experience. You might have to work a little bit harder at it, but it gets the job done. I mean, very, very rarely have I walked away from a gig feeling like nobody was paying attention. Maybe once or twice. I mean, yeah, it happens, but it doesn't happen very often. I feel like not much anymore.
No, not at all, yeah. Your question's about the songwriting question, and I had a really hard time with that.
Yeah.
Because I love music so much, and I listen to so much music, that I was like, I want to have a great answer for this. But then it came to what so many songwriters have said, where it's an idea just strikes you. Like, there's a story about when Johnny Cash and Roger Miller were on tour together, Roger Miller said to the band, pull over. And the band pulls over, and he runs out to a tree off the side of the road. And within 20 minutes, he writes down the lyrics to King of the Road, his biggest hit, and gets back on the van. And I feel like that's so telling, because I wish there was a thing where you're like, I'm going to listen to music, I'm going to write a song. But I feel like when it comes down to it, it is that bolt of lightning where it's something hits you. And no matter what music you're listening to, whether it's Notorious B.I.G. or John Prine, if something's not moving you, you're not going to write.
Both of those do happen.
So therefore, I really enjoy that question, the analyzing of, you know, what causes someone to write a song. Whether it's a moment in life, a song you hear, a sound you hear, I think no one can really pinpoint when it's going to happen.
It's just the
And I love
spark.
That feeling.
It just hits
I love that feeling.
Keith Richards said he woke up from like a dead sleep in the middle of the night. He had the riff to Satisfaction in his head. He recorded it just by itself on a crappy little tape recorder.
And then fell back asleep.
And
the tape's still running.
Hours, and it was there.
Well, I guess a good question to end on, since we're talking about, you know, listening to all sorts of kinds of music, what is, I guess, an artist that you guys have been listening to lately that you would recommend our listeners to go and check out?
I would check out Johnny Fritz. He's one of my
modern
favorites.
Modern, Johnny Fritz.
I might have a sibling out there that's playing music. My last name's Fritz.
Oh, really? Okay, there you go.
Once known as Johnny Corndog, now known as Johnny.
Once known as Johnny Corndog.
Can we change your nickname to Corndog now?
No, I'm Sammy Corndog.
Yeah.
His fiddle player used to be Josh Headley, who is now the golden boy of Third Man Records. But he's been in Nashville for a long time. He's a great songwriter, and he has a lot of cool, like, Native American influence in his songwriting, which I think is really, really cool and different. And
it's been around for a while, but for me, a constant go back to is Marty Stewart. Mm-hmm. Been doing it for years, and his last record was just brilliant. I've been going back to the record Badlands recently from him, and every time I listen to one of his records, I hear something new. And if an artist can do that, I mean, whether you listen to it one time or 37 times and you hear something new each listen, and Marty Stewart can do that. I really enjoy his music and his work.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The note that we do need to end on, though, is that any plugs?
Yes!
We got some great stuff coming up.
Awesome. Yeah, I know.
The floor is yours, then.
Well, we have a new-ish record called Heyday. You should get it. You can download it. You can order it. You can buy it.
Yeah, we were very proud. Baltimore Magazine recently listed us as one of the 50 artists in Baltimore that you should know about. And they said it was great because it was like any track off of Heyday, go for it. So we were very happy to hear that because that record means so much to us.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure Baltimore Magazine will appreciate the publicity too.
There you go. And then in the Pennsylvania world, we're coming back to town soon for the Glen Rock...
Arts,
what's that called?
Arts and Brew Fest.
Arts and Brew Fest, yeah.
And then Trifecta, right?
Yep.
Is coming up.
And then Trifecta's in Baltimore. Yeah, that's a kind of a food truck festival meets music. That should be a lot of fun as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's just one thing that I know that we forgot to throw in. You guys have to retell the story of your time in Indianapolis.
Oh.
opening for the best blues guitar player in Indianapolis.
To go back to that, though, Indianapolis for us was one of the first time that the whole band rented a vehicle, packed it up, and went out of state. So it was a lot of fun. It was a very new experience for us, and we were just on cloud nine the whole time. And we get to this place called the Rathskeller, and it's like this castle-looking, just gothic architecture. It was beautiful.
German beer garden.
And they treated us really well. They made us feel at home. And then the audience was having a good time. But all of a sudden, this guy walks up to me, and he's real serious. He says, "Do you know that tonight you're playing with Gene Deere?"
Opening for Gene
Deere. Yeah, so I didn't know
we
that.
We didn't get the privilege of playing with him.
But. And he tells us, "Well, Gene Deere is the best blues guitarist in all of Indiana." Now, I don't know if that's a competitive field or not. I don't know if there's many blues guitarists in Indiana. But I think the flyer to that show is still in the trunk of my car.
Yeah.
And it brings me good luck to this day.
Oh, my gosh.
I hope to cross paths with Gene once more.
Gene looked like a regular 50-year-old guy with a Stratocaster and long hair.
It was a good set.
Sounds like a regular 50-year-old guy. Sounds like the definition of Indiana.
Sounds like the best blues guitarist in all of Indiana to me. I mean, he definitely he looked the part.
For the people listening, I want them to know that I have the right to make that claim being from Indiana.
Fair enough.
Look up Gene Deere.
But that was our first, like I said, trip out of state, and we just really look forward to, you know, each mile that we take as a band and as a musician, and it's gonna be a fun ride.
Anything else?
No, I think good to wrap up. Basically, I'm just going to fade out of this.
Thanks for listening. This concludes the very first episode of the Flat Nickel Podcast with our guest, The Herd of Main Street. Please come back in the future and tune in again.